This episode is brought to you by Thorn, and I have some incredible news for any of you that are in the military, first responder, or medical professions. In an effort to give back, Thorn is now offering you an ongoing 35% off each and every one of your purchases of their incredible nutritional solutions. Now, Thorn is the official supplement of CrossFit, the UFC, the Mayo Clinic, the Human Performance Project, and multiple special operations organizations. I myself have used them for several years, and that is why I brought them on as a sponsor. Some of my favorite products they have are their Multivitamin Elite, their Whey Protein, the Super EPA, and then most recently, Cinequil. As a firefighter, a stuntman, and a martial artist, I've had my share of brain trauma and sleep deprivation, and Cinequil is their latest brain health supplement. Now, to qualify for the 35% off, go to thorn.com, thorne.com. Click on sign in and then create a new account. You will see the opportunity to register as a first responder or member of military. When you click on that, it will take you through verification with GovX. You'll simply choose a profession, provide one piece of documentation, and then you are verified for life. From that point onwards, you will continue to receive 35% off through Thorn. Now, for those of you who don't qualify, there is still the 10% off using the code BTS10, behind the shield 10, for a one-time purchase. Now, to learn more about Thorn, go to episode 323 of the Behind the Shield podcast with Joel Totoro and Wes Barnett. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name's James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome on the show veteran firefighter and founder of Rogue Firemanship Training, Logan Broberg. Now, in this conversation, we discuss all things firefighter fitness, from the 343 Hero Challenge that we both just competed in, his journey through multiple smoke diver programs, training in or out of gear, fire department fitness standards, helping firefighters chase their fitness goals, and so much more. Now, before we get to this incredible conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single five-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of over 1,000 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So with that being said, I introduce to you Logan Broberg. Enjoy. Well, Logan, I want to start by welcoming you to my home today. And we just competed in the 343 Hero Challenge. That'd be a good kind of icebreaker to get this going. Talk to me about your experience a couple of years ago and then what you witnessed this year doing that competition.
Yeah, thanks for having me and for all your hospitality so far. And yeah, the first time I competed was 2 years ago, and it's a really great experience. You know, it's all for charity. And did it with one of my buddies, Pena, and we just kind of went in and just had fun. He had never really done a competition like that, and I never really had either. I do my style of training, I would consider it like cross training. I don't necessarily always do CrossFit stuff, but I do a lot of those, methods and modalities that they have. And then last year I was supposed to compete, but I ended up having nasal surgery because I had a deviated septum, and it just happened to be I still couldn't work out. And then shortly after that, I ended up injuring my back anyways. I was having some back issues. So sat out, watched a bunch of members from my department. They competed, watched them compete. And then this last time, this past weekend, was feeling good, so signed up. And my buddy who used to work with me in Kissimmee, he's actually down in Miami-Dade now, but he's really into CrossFit. He competes at a pretty high level. So I asked if he wanted to do a team with me under the Rogue Firemanship team name, just to kind of help also get the company name out there. And it was a really good time. I think my favorite part was, even though we were all competing, Everybody was cheering each other on. You know, if you weren't warming up for your heat, mostly everybody was on the side cheering everybody on. And there was people from all over the state of Florida. And it's just super humbling, you know, seeing people that kind of have the same mindset. They're all, you know, fit or they want to be fit and they're doing it for a greater cause. It's just always awesome to be part of that.
People say to me, brotherhood and sisterhood is dead in the fire service. And I tell them, you're just looking in the wrong places. I would argue that the Hero Challenge is one place to go see where it's alive and well.
100%. That's what I've learned in my short career so far, is if it's not necessarily within your four walls, then you just need to get out your four walls of your department, because I see stuff happening all the time across the country to benefit, you know, brothers and sisters that are going through some hard times.
Absolutely. Well, let's start at the very beginning of your journey, and obviously we'll walk into the fire service. Tell me where you were born and tell me a little bit about your family dynamic, what your parents did, how many siblings?
Yep. So I was born in South Florida. I grew up in a small town called Loxahatchee. Most people have never heard of it, so I just tell them that I grew up in West Palm, because it was about 20 minutes west of West Palm. And my mom and dad they're still together, and I have a little sister. She's about 4 to 5 years younger than me. My mom was a labor and delivery nurse for over 25 years, and she worked in a town called Belgrade, which, if you're not familiar with that town, it's a pretty rough town. It's very low income, a lot of farm workers and sugarcane fields out there. So that's kind of what she was dealing with her whole career. And then my dad was a police officer for same amount of time down in Boynton Beach. And same thing, there's some pretty rough areas down in Boynton Beach. So he pretty much was on the streets his whole career too, was a sergeant, which is like equivalent to what a lieutenant is for us on the fire truck. And, you know, just kind of grew up like a blue collar type family. My dad, for a few years on the side, he had a masonry business. And around that time, I was in middle school, so he would kind of make me work with him during the summers, busting up concrete sidewalks, reforming them, and pouring them. And his big thing was that if I didn't do good in school, that this was most likely the type of work I was going to be doing, and I did not really enjoy it. I wish I had paid attention a little more, because I definitely could, you know, be better to know how to do some of that stuff, but it was just miserable. It was South Florida in the middle of summer, and I just wanted to get it over with and get back home.
Brilliant. So let's talk about your dad first. Boynton Beach, we had Hugh Bruder on talking about their recent switch to 2472, but I don't want to dive into that at the moment. But there's this kind of thought that, oh, it's a very affluent city, and that's how they're able to do it. Talk to me about the other side, because most of us, you know, no matter where we work, there's the, you know, the wealthy area, and then there's the low-income area where you tend to usually see more people struggling, the crime, that kind of thing. So what were some of the stories you remember him talking about his time in Boynton?
Yeah, so I think South Florida as a whole, especially in Palm Beach County, it's pretty unique because, you know, in the county, there's obviously money. You know, you have the town of Palm Beach, which is Palm Beach Island, and, you know, where, you know, Trump and all the other millionaires live. But in pretty much every city on that East Coast, is you'll have, you know, really nice areas. More out west is kind of like your more suburban neighborhoods, blue collar neighborhoods. But right before you cross the train tracks to get to the beach side is usually, in every single city along there is, you know, just low income neighborhoods, high drug and high crime rates. So my dad, like I said, he worked in Boynton Beach, and in that area, they had a street called Cherry Hill. And that was usually one of the worst neighborhoods in that area. And he would just always tell me stories, you know, of things going on. Once I got a little older, he would let me do some ride alongs with him. So I would ride around, kind of see what was going on. And at the time, there was a big gang issue down there where they had a lot of Haitian gangs kind of come onto the scene. And the History Channel, they actually did a whole gangland episode on one of the bigger Haitian gangs down there. And they were kind of causing a lot of havoc because they were doing a lot of drive-by shootings at the time. And a lot of, you know, innocent people were getting hurt because of that.
That was interesting when the comments were made about people eating pets. And my whole thing was, well, if we're talking about, you know, issues with Haitians, then let's talk about, you said, the Haitian gangs. Because I remember living down in Hialeah, or living in Pembroke Pines and working in Hialeah, you know, there were certain areas that if you went in, you know, you'd be lucky if you got out again. So, you know, the people that come from such a war-torn place and then, you know, are implanted here, and then obviously that criminality comes with them. You know, I think that to me is a much more important conversation than maybe, you know, one or two examples of maybe a family pet being taken.
Yeah, 100%. I think what's unique about South Florida too is it's, you know, a lot of people call it a melting pot because there's people from everywhere come to South Florida. You know, you have the port right there. Cuba's not too far away. So, you know, over the years, we had a lot of Cuban refugees that would come. And so it's just a big melting pot. You know, the Haitians were not the only ones causing crime. I just remember, you know, there's a lot of news stories because they were, you know, they were doing what gangs do. They're trying to get territory from whatever other resident gangs are there. And they were just very vicious and very, you know, aggressive.
Yeah. Well, I think that's it. That's, it's not just the Haitians. That's the point, is that we have, I point this out a lot, with there's this kind of negativity towards the police and why aren't they doing enough? And why do they look like they're going to war the way they're dressed?
Right.
And no one's saying, well, why are our streets so dangerous? Why do we have the level of gangs? You go to Norway or Portugal, they don't have that. They don't, you know what I mean? So this is a very, I think to me, a much bigger conversation than, you know, again, like I said, a handful of pets going missing, is the fact that all cultures and countries and colors and creeds, we have them represented because of our illicit drug trade and the prohibition of drugs. We've created, we've encouraged this criminality on our streets, which then you and I and, you know, our men and women in law enforcement respond to. And then if it doesn't go right, we're the ones thrown under the bus.
Yeah, 100%. You know, and they want to defund the police and they don't really understand what that actually means. It's really just taking resources that they may have had to help combat these issues. It's taking that away because I don't think a lot of people realize that certain crimes require specialty units. It's not just your normal street or beat cop that's handling these issues. You know, if there's a drug issue, they have a whole narcotics unit that's handling that, or they have a whole gang unit that's, their only job is just to go after gangs and, you know, bust those things up.
Absolutely. Well, switching to the other parent, your mom, labor delivery, working in an area where I'm assuming there's a lot of migrant workers.
Yep.
What were some of the things or the unique lens that she had working with those communities?
Yes, I remember her telling me, you know, there'd be 13-year-old girls having babies. And like I said, just very low income, high drug rate city. So, you know, she was constantly delivering drug babies and dealing with that. And the biggest thing that always stuck out was just the, you know, they kind of, I don't want to say they isolated me from that. I was aware of what was going on in the world, but as I got older, I couldn't imagine, you know, being 13 years old and being pregnant and giving birth. You know, it's just, that's crazy to me. And like I said, I think a lot of people, if they don't hear about it or don't see it, it's out of sight, out of mind. They don't realize that these things are happening every day and they're not new issues. And, you know, sadly she really enjoyed her work because she had to be good at her job. You know, it wasn't in a cush area where they had a lot of resources, you know, in that city, that was one of the only hospitals out there. And then the next hospital over was, you know, 30, 40 minutes over. She didn't have to deal with some of the trauma stuff because obviously she was labor and delivery, but, you know, people would roll up to that hospital because it was the closest one and, you know, there's gunshot wounds and stuff. They're just dropping them off at the front door.
Mm-hmm. I had to call that. It was one of the stories in my new book that I wrote about, and it was a true story behind the story. But yeah, and I mean, you know, blood in, blood out, it's all about the homies. Well, trust me, you know, when they just throw you out of a car and drive away, there's nothing brotherly about that.
Right.
With that as well, what about the human trafficking element? When you look at a lot of the migrant workers now, people don't think that men are trafficked, but a lot of this, you know, these workers on these farms and these restaurants, you know, a lot of them sometimes there's coyotes and there's trafficking element too. Was she ever exposed to that? I know it's kind of a new conversation these days.
No, not that I remember. I remember, you know, when I was growing up at the time, you know, it was I graduated high school in 2012. So you figure early 2000s till 2012, the big thing down there, I remember my dad talking about, was the pill mills, you know, and he said you would pull up behind a car and it's like three or four, you know, white guys in it and they have plates from like Ohio. And he's like, you just flip your lights on and they'd want to be taken off because they were just coming down here, hopping from doctor's clinic to doctor's clinic, getting the pain pills. And then they would go back up obviously and sell them. And I remember that was a big thing in South Florida as well, where there was like hundreds of those doctor's offices that were illegally, well, not illegally, but that, you know, the doctors were just making money. So they're prescribing everybody and their mother the pain pills. And then now fast forward 15, 20 years and everybody's addicted to opiates now. And now that's a whole nother issue. You know, my dad, he got on in the 90s where it was probably crack was the big drug. And now where I'm working, it's majority, you know, opiates. You know, we're not really dealing with, I haven't really heard of anybody recently in my career, you know, when I run on a patient, they're not smoking crack anymore. It's either meth or heroin or, you know, maybe they'll do cocaine, but it's, you know, it's just kind of crazy how the times change and stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah. When I moved to the US, we started off in Orlando. I was one at the Fire Academy. And then I went to work for Hialeah. When I was down there, my ex, my son's mother, she got hired in this pseudo doctor's office. And as time went on, she was like, it's really weird. I've got these people, you know, flying down from New York and Ohio and West Virginia to come get these prescriptions from this doctor. And he's just writing them, you know, all day. And they come down and, you know, or we're like overnighting these prescriptions to people or whatever it is. And it was it. And luckily she kind of had this moment which like, this just doesn't seem right. And she left. And it wasn't too long before all the ATF, you know, gangs were, you know, kicking in doors and getting these people. But I had a guy, San Quinones, on the show who wrote Dreamland, and it's all about that. And then once the pill mill shut down, that's when the Mexican gangs started bringing the black tar heroin. And you had all these people that were dope sick that were relying on these pill mills. Not saying that was right, but when it was shut down, you had all these people strung out. And so now it was just an easy target for the cartels to come in. So when we even talk about the whole border cartel issue, you know, our prohibition, our American addicts we consume 75% of the world's opioids. You know, that's all because of, you know, OxyContin and all these things that started this whole, you know, epidemic.
Yeah, it's sad, you know, because you have a normal, you know, productive member of society. Maybe they have a family, they have a good career, they get addicted to these pills, and then it's just a downward spiral. Or, you know, some of these athletes, same thing. Or, you know, we've heard stories of even police and firemen, you know, they get addicted to the pain pills because of an injury, and then it just spirals out of control. So
I know three that have died from overdoses from opioids.
Yeah. Sad.
Yeah. It's horrendous. Well, we're going to obviously talk about fitness as well. So going back to your early life, when you were in the school ages, what were you doing and playing as far as sports and exercise?
So I tried baseball out. I really didn't like it when I was really young. It was very boring to me. It usually is at that age. Now that I realize it's, you know, unless you're hitting the ball, it's probably not very fun. So the big sport in my community where I grew up was football. So I played football pretty much my whole life all the way up into high school. And then nobody really told me that being 110 pounds as a freshman, I was probably not going to make the football team. So tried out for the freshman football team. That was a really cool experience, though, because they had a very good weightlifting program. They were very big on strength and conditioning. So if they said if you wanted to try out for the freshman football team, you'd come the summer before school started and work. They showed you how to lift weights at a full weight room. And they showed you how to lift weights and strength train. Then you would try out for the football team. And if you made the cut, you made the cut. If not, you didn't. So I didn't make the cut. And that was kind of that was my first dose, I would say, of failing something. Cause I'd played rec sports my whole childhood. And, you know, you pay to play when you're on a rec team, you know, you pay, you get picked to be on the team and you play. So I asked them, you know, what could I do to just kind of help my chances to get on the team next time? Cause they have a freshman JV and varsity team. And they're like, well, you could try out for JVD in the spring. And, so I elected to actually be kind of like the equipment manager, which was more or less a glorified water boy. So I was a water
boy.
Well,
he ended up playing for the team. So I've seen the movie.
Yeah. That didn't happen for me because what ended up happening is when school started, I did the water boy thing, and that was cool because they said if I was part of the team in that aspect, I could get weightlifting class instead of PE. So my freshman year, I still got to continue weightlifting. And then a bunch of my buddies tried out for the wrestling team. And the way the wrestling team worked is you would make the team no matter what. You would just be JV or a backup. But if you wanted to be varsity, you would wrestle off for the varsity spot. So once football season ended, wrestling season was starting. I went into the wrestling room and just fell in love with it after the first practice because it was just a grind, you know, and I liked that it was weight class based. It didn't matter how big or small you were because it was all weight classes. So joined the wrestling team and kind of gave up the water boy thing and never looked back ever since. Wrestled my whole high school career. Same thing freshman year, I got pretty much whooped every match. Asked the coach what I could do to improve, and he told me, well, most kids take the season off to either play other sports or they just take the season off. So he's like, if you want to get really good and make up time, you just have to wrestle all year round. So that's what I would do during the off season. I would go to off season tournaments and off season, what they called clinics, where guys at the higher level, whether it be college or Olympic level, would go around. And a lot of them always came to Florida just probably to make a vacation out of it. You'd pay, they'd show you a bunch of different techniques, and you would wrestle guys from all over the state and just keep getting better. So my sophomore year, I came back, made the varsity team at 119 pounds. Then my junior year, I ended up becoming a captain, wrestled at 125, and senior year was still a captain, wrestled at 132, and I ended up breaking the single season takedown record for that year for my school. And my ultimate goal was obviously to be a state champion, but I fell short in that goal. But it really taught me a lot of lessons just about life, you know, because what was nice about it is when you went out on the mat, it was on you. So if you messed something up, you kind of had to take accountability for yourself. If you lost the match, you couldn't blame the ref and can't blame your coach. But as far as the team aspect, you had to be a good drilling partner and you had to have good drilling partners around you. So kind of like the fire service, it really does parallel because you and your partner may have to go do a single task on the fire ground to get it done, but you're also relying on your other teammates to get their single task done. And if you don't get that task done, it's on you. It's nobody else's fault. So I really enjoyed it. And I did a little bit of jiu-jitsu once I got out of high school. But now I just don't have as much time as I'd like now to dedicate to it. So
yeah, when we first met in the 3-4-3, immediately I noticed your right ear. It was slightly cauliflower. And I'm like, yeah, he has to be a grappler at some point.
I was.
Yeah, it was interesting because I ask a lot of people that about the contrast between the team sports and individual sports, and I played both as well. But the, you know, if you can sandbag in a team sometimes and get away with it, you know, there's blaming sometimes. Ah, you missed, you know, missed that goal, whatever it was. And this is what I loved about the individual one, which is why I lean more towards that. Is exactly like you said, when you're on the mat and you're against that person, you either win or you lose. And even I remember when I used to be close on points in martial arts, like, okay, well, that's not good enough. I can't let the judges decide. I need to decide. So I'm still not good enough. It's still on me. So it does definitely carry over to the fire service. Cause yeah, when you're, you know, in South Florida going through a collapse maze, you know, and it's 110 outside and, you know, you're halfway through the, you know, the maze, for lack of a better word, you know, no one else is coming to help you. It's that little voice in your mind that's either going to get you to panic or to keep pushing forward and get it done.
Yeah, what I really liked about it too is if anybody has ever grappled before, they could also speak to this, but it's probably one of the hardest things physically that you can do because you're using muscles that you're not going to hit while you're in the gym just performing your normal, you know, compound lifts or even your isolation lifts. And it's a huge, you know, cardiovascular event too. You know, you're probably at 170, 180 beats a minute because you're trying to impose your will on somebody else, get them to quit, and get them to allow you to either pin them or take them down and get the points that you need. And the wrestling practices, I remember our coach, he would take us to the track before practice would start. And I mean, practice started, but we weren't in the wrestling room yet. We'd pretty much do whatever the track team's practice was. So we would either run a few miles or we'd run intervals around the track. And then we'd go into the wrestling room, drill our moves for an hour or two, and then live wrestle for an hour. So you're talking 3-4 hours after school every day, just grinding out in the wrestling room. And then as I got older and wanted to accomplish more, I was even, you know, I was a high school kid waking up early before school. I'd go run 3 to 5 miles every day before school just to try to, you know, get an edge and, you know, make myself have a better chance of being successful because, you know, it's addicting when you want to win and it's you versus another person.
100%. What about career aspirations? What were you dreaming of becoming when you were still in the school age?
So my whole life, I pretty much wanted to be a cop. because I wanted to, you know, I heard my dad's stories. My dad was a very well-respected leader in his department by his guys. And at a young age, I even kind of caught on to that just by how they would act around him and the things he would do for them. Some of the stories I heard were, you know, instead of just throwing the book at him, he would do what he could as a servant leader and make sure maybe, you know, if they were a good guy and they just made a mistake and they were honest, you know, he would try to help them out a little bit and not just throw the whole administrative paperwork at them. And, you know, my dad, I looked up to my dad. I still look up to my dad now. He's 6'4", 260 pounds, you know, big guy, nothing at all how I'm built. Guys still make fun of me about that. But yeah, that was my hero, you know, so I wanted to do what he did. And he was, especially towards the end of his career, he was really against that. He could see where police work was going. You know, they didn't have body cams quite yet, but, you know, he was on the job before dash cams. And then when the dash cams came, then, you know, the tasers came about and they could log or they could track, you know, when a taser was deployed. And he could kind of see where, not necessarily that people were being held accountable, but it was like almost over, like too much. They're overbearing, you know, towards the end of his career, guys were getting complaints on excessive use of force when it was something they needed to do, but just because the citizen complains and the chiefs want to appease them or, you know, it gets caught on camera. So he really didn't want me to do that. And, you know, I was like, no, that's what I want to do. And he also didn't want me to go into the military because he had served in the Army. My uncle was a Marine in Vietnam. My uncle was like 15 to 20 years older than my dad. And my grandpa was a World War II veteran. So he didn't want me to go in the military. He said enough Brobergs have served the country. And at the time, you know, we were over in the Middle East. So he's like, I'm not raising you to go get blown up over there, basically, is what he would tell me. Which, fair enough. And I really had no aspirations to go the military route anyways. I really just wanted to be a cop. And he sat me down one day and said, you know, he had a buddy that was on the fire department in Boynton. And he said, I want you to do a ride along with my buddy Ken. And if you don't like it after this, then you can go be a cop. So I went and did a ride along. I went in on a Sunday. So I didn't know this at the time, but obviously it's typically a more chill day, you know, for firehouse life. But I showed up and he went through the whole truck with me. They were doing their truck checkout. And then we ate breakfast together. We ran a couple medical calls. We ate lunch together. We did a workout in the afternoon in the gym. And then I ended up going home right after dinner. You know, ran some calls in between, nothing crazy. But what really attracted me to the fire service was the camaraderie and like just the fact that you're part of a crew, basically. Because when I wrestled, me and my friends who wrestled together, we were all really close. Like we'd wrestle, you know, during the week. And then we'd wrestle on the weekends and then we'd pick somebody's house to hang out at that night. And, you know, we spent all of our time together, almost like a crew. And I really liked that. And that's ultimately what attracted me to the fire service. The fact that they could work out on duty, because I was still into fitness then too. And that you had to be in shape for your job. It's something different every day. You know, it's challenging mentally and physically. And, you know, my dad even told me, he's like, when you're a cop, you're in your car for most of your shift by yourself. You know, unless it's like a high crime, really busy area like in LA, you don't have a partner. Mm-hmm. You know,
which is wrong. I've said this to so many police officers. Like, we wonder why there's issues.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if either of us was walking down the street and we had to go hands on with one person versus two, I mean, it's common sense. There's a lot of people walking those streets that are a lot bigger or just better at fighting than I am. Doesn't matter if I got a badge on my chest, but the moment you have two people, two well-trained people, that's a real force multiplier.
Yep. So I came back, told my dad, I guess, this is what I want to do. And so I signed up for EMT school, went to nighttime EMT school because I was taking some college classes during the day at the time. Got my EMT. And then that same guy, Ken, he told me that he did fire school at Lake Tech, which was, I had never heard of like the city of Tavares, but it's in Lake County. And he said they had a program when he went through, back when he started, it was like 20 years prior at the time, but it was an apprenticeship program where you could live at a fire station and go to school. So he called the chief up there. It was for the Mount Dora Fire Department. And I got into the fire school at Lake Tech, moved up right after I graduated high school. And Well, I should say it was the spring after I graduated high school, because I had finished one semester of college. And so I lived in Mount Dora's fire station while I went to fire school, and that really solidified my decision because, you know, during the week I'd be in fire school, I'd come back, I'd have dinner with the crew, and instead of driving all the way home 3 hours back to South Florida, I would just hang out at the station for the weekend, and it really helped me because they'd help me with my knots and whatever stuff I needed to pass for fire school, and I got to run some calls with them and really see what the lifestyle was about. And then I came back home, and at the time, it was highly competitive. So this was probably like the summer of 2013, the tail end of the recession. And there had, I didn't know this, but there had been like hiring freezes for 5 to 8 years. So it was highly competitive to get a job, nothing like what it is now. And applied to a few different processes. I remember I did a process with Sebring's fire department. And I was so naive because, you know, I never really worked like a real job that I had an interview for. I always worked like a lifeguard job or whatever the case was. And I know I bombed the interview, especially looking back now. But it was crazy. It was for like, I think it was like for $9 or $10 an hour for a firefighter EMT, you know, in small Sebring in the middle of Highlands County. And it was kind of crazy that I didn't get the job. And so I went back home and, you know, my parents were like, well, you might as well, since you're living at home, just go to medic school. That way you can make yourself more marketable. Especially in South Florida at the time, if you weren't a medic, you had to be like a chief's son or something to get hired as a firefighter EMT. So
well, what's funny is when I was looking, which was 2004, I went to Mid-Florida Tech, Orlando, and my son's mother wanted to move down to Miami, kind of pursue the whole entertainment industry down there. And I was told by all the instructors in Orlando, oh, you'll never get hired down south unless you're a medic and you speak Spanish. And I went down, and the city of Hialeah was just dying for people because they, I mean, it was still competitive, but they weren't as sought after as Miami-Dade. They literally were being paid half what some of the cities around them were. So I think it was 3 months I was hired. But it's funny, that rhetoric, you know, sometimes it's almost discouraging for people like, oh, you'll never, because it's like, well, throw your freaking name in anyway. Don't be dissuaded by that.
Yeah, and even the instructors at LaTeX, they kind of said the same thing, but they even told us, they were like, just apply everywhere, you know. And so I went through medic school, which actually worked out very well. I started medic school when I was 20, and then I went, you know, it was about a year. I went through Palm Beach State, was living at home, so I could just focus on medic school. And I was also volunteering for a small department down there called North Palm Beach. They're a one-station department down there, and they had a volunteer program, which was really nice because then I could do rides with them and keep my fire and EMT cert up. And it was crazy that I tell some of these young guys this now. I feel like I'm like, not necessarily that I'm that old salty guy. It's like, you guys don't know what it's like. But I remember I had to go to those meetings for like, I think it was 4 to 6 months before I got on. I would go in my civilian clothes and just stand around there and watch them do their drill, because there was even a line just to become a volunteer for them. And the way they did it is, as soon as you put your application in, they just told us like, hey, just come every week and we'll just wait till a spot opens up. So I finally, a couple spots opened up. I got in, did that for a year. And then towards the end of medic school, I had like a month left of medic school. I was actively testing at the end of my medic school because we were in our, they call it our capstone. But if for people don't know, it's basically just doing rides. You're not having to go to class every day. And Kissimmee gave me my shot. So I remember the training lieutenant called me, and I was actually at a clinical, such a small world. I was at a clinical with Palm Beach County doing my ride time, and one of the firefighter paramedics there, he had just left Kissimmee, like not that long ago, and he was at the station when I got the phone call. So he kind of gave me the scoop on how it was up there, and I was pretty excited because he was like, yeah, you know, they burn a pretty good amount. They have really good equipment. And he just said, you know, at the time, they don't pay, obviously, what South Florida pays. That was he even said the only reason he came down to South Florida was just the pay. And he had already kind of missed some of the camaraderie and the brotherhood that Kissimmee had. And I remember it when he called me, the training lieutenant, and I hung up the phone, the butterflies that I had, it was like I had the golden ticket. And I'm sure you felt the same way, you know, when you first got hired.
Oh, yeah.
It was very competitive.
So competitive.
You know, now you see departments are hiring kids out of high school to like put them through the fire academy and all that on and get paid an hourly wage. It's just, it's crazy, but it's what has to be done right now, you know, because for whatever reason, people aren't flocking to the trades as much anymore.
Well, let me ask you that question before I load it and give you my opinion. Why do you think it is that you experience such competition when you were testing, I mean, only 10 years ago, you know, and we're seeing what we're seeing now?
You know, we do talk about this a lot at the station, and to be honest, I really don't know. I mean, I have my theories, but obviously I don't have enough data to back it up. I don't know if it's more because the schools are pushing people to go to college first and they're not necessarily looking at the trades. And maybe, you know, I even brought this up in my own department. I say, why we do these pub eds all the time. We go to the preschools and the elementary schools to show them the truck. And I said, because we're still having recruiting issues now, but a couple of years ago when we were having them, I said, why don't we do like what the Marines do and go to the high school or go to some of these sports teams that are at the end of their practices and say, hey, you know, maybe you're not going to college for athletics, but have you guys ever thought about a career in the fire service? You still get to be part of a team and you can make a pretty good living wage while you're still living at home with your parents until you get on your feet. And, you know, I want somebody who can work in a team, has some athletic, physical capabilities, and has maybe dealt with a little bit of adversity when you compete in sports. And I think the other problem in Florida right now, too, is for many, many years, you had to go get your own education before you could get hired, where a lot of states, they will do essentially like a civil service exam, hire you, and then put you through a recruit school. And I think especially right now and now as economy, maybe you're not going to get as many people that are willing to not make a living wage while they have to support their families to go to school. And then they're not even guaranteed a job yet.
See, what's been interesting comparing, and I think because I tested 20 plus years ago, it was very different. Like the internet was still kind of in its infancy then. And I remember there was one website, it was called like the goldennuggets.com or something. And if you were going to do your, you know, the big stumbling block seemed to be the oral interview. So it was all these kind of, you know, do's and don'ts to prepare you for that. And the reality is just be yourself is what it should have said. But that was it. So you Google what's it like to be a firefighter. You know, it was, I joke about it all the time. It was mustaches, leather helmets, and getting babies out of fires. If you Google it now, you see not only firefighter divorce, cancer, suicide, addiction, you know, all the things, but you also can pull up, you know, how much are they getting paid? What are the actual hours? It used to like not even be on the app. I didn't know what I was going to get paid from Hialeah till weeks into the academy. Yeah. I shit
yeah,
you
not. Right. Yeah, you're right.
So so now you see it and now you learn about mandatory overtime and you've got these younger generation that have been brought up to understand mental health, to understand physical fitness, some of them. And they look at this on paper and they're like, that sounds fucking awful. You know, that the worst case that we're in at the moment. And so this is what's exciting, though, is if you fix those things, and we were talking before we hit record about the 2472, if you show these young recruits that actually we're going to create an environment that will allow you to thrive, not break you down and destroy your marriage, I think we're going to see a U-turn back to people lining up around the building. But I think that, you know, the dwindling amount of people that are applicable because of the obesity crisis, but also the fact that we've done a terrible job telling people what we actually do. And we still walk around saying that we have this amazing shift, but we don't. You know, I think all those have finally come to the critical mass. And so it's less about Gen Z not wanting to work and more about them actually understanding what's most important to them. You know, so we did kind of went in blindly and didn't really question it. And I think now with so many of our brothers and sisters that we've buried, this next generation is actually coming with fresh eyes going, you know what, you need to fix these things before we get excited to come work for you. It's not they don't have service in their heart, but they're also prioritizing their health and their relationships, which I think is brilliant. So they're forcing us to change.
Yeah, 100%. And I agree with you. I think we do a very bad job of explaining the real expectations of what the job is like to these younger people. They think that we just cut cars and fight fire every day. And I'm an instructor at the academy as well. And I'm straight up with them. I said, you're probably going to run 4 to 5 calls after midnight, and they're most likely going to be medicals or non-emergency type calls. And if you are not prepared for that, like, this may not be the job for you. You know, it's pretty much 80%, you know, medical and maybe 5 to 10% extrications, 5 to 10% fires, if that. And I'm not discrediting, like, you know, especially in our city, we do still fight fire and you do still have to be prepared for those types of things. But I think the expectation on the majority of the calls you're going to run every day is you need to be upfront. Cause I have also noticed that these younger employees of the departments are starting to complain about the calls a lot sooner than they really should be. You know, when I have a year or two guy complaining about having to go pick grandma up off the ground, it's like, dude, what do you think we do? Like, they don't have anybody else to call. They can't call the cops, right? They can't call the garbage man. They can't call the electrician. They got to call us. And I do try to do a good job of that and outlining it for these recruits. And then it's up to the crews on the department to kind of, you know, keep the culture going, which I think has also been I think it's always been an issue, but it's an issue in a lot of departments. You know, you can't control where some of these recruits end up. And then sometimes you could have somebody that has a really good attitude and really wants to do a good job. And then they just get kind of stepped on and then they get ruined.
Yeah. I remember my last place, multiple people said, oh, you wait, they'll break you down. And I was like, how sad is that?
That's terrible.
That's the narrative in this place, you know? And I get it. I see it. And they did. They didn't. Let me rephrase that. There was that element. I didn't allow it to adjust my, you know, my direction. But I mean, in the end, I just decided to step out of that department and try and be the solution from the outside. But yeah, that is the ethos, is that they'll break you down. And that shouldn't be, you know, if you go to the NFL locker room and they go to the quarterback, oh, you wait, they'll break you down. Like, no one would stand for that, you know, no. But why is that the norm for police or fire? It's insane. So what about the fitness side? You came from this, you know, athlete background as a wrestler. What were the standards at the front doors of some of these departments? And then how did you start to become, you know, someone who was a kind of leader when it came to firefighter fitness?
So, yeah, I've always been into fitness, especially I was always smaller statured and I looked up to somebody like my dad who was bigger. So I always wanted to be bigger, especially when I got on the fire department. At first I had really good cardio because I had wrestled all through high school, was running all the time. And then some of my arrogance was like, well, since I've done that for so long, I don't need to do any more cardio at all. I just want to look good and get big because that's what being a firefighter is. And you just have to be big to get the job done. So I was only doing lifting and, you know, the bro workouts, you know, the vanity muscles and stuff like that. And once I had a couple years on the job, on a couple fires, I had just really not performed to what I should have been performing to. And so I changed my training up, especially because I had found out about some smoke diver programs and decided to go to the Georgia Smoke Diver Program in 2017. So at the time I had... it's like 112. So I had like maybe four years on, and I'd never really been pushed like that. And so I was unsuccessful. I actually failed out within the first 30 minutes of the first PT session of the program.
What was it that, what was the deficit in your preparation, and what was the movement that you failed on?
So surprisingly, the way they do it for, if you're an out-of-stater, is they let you come take the entrance test the day before, so that way you don't have to fly or drive up there, you know, beforehand. I passed that, but what actually got me, believe it or not, was just body weight, calisthenics, and holds, like something that I didn't really put a lot of stock in because I was like, oh, I wrestled, I'll be fine. I've done push-ups and jumping jacks before. And, you know, towards the end of the PT session, I couldn't even hold a push-up anymore. So they just told me, stand up, you're done. You know, you're not even meeting the standard anymore. So a huge slice of humble pie. I remember we did an exit interview with one of the ops chiefs because they run an incident command system within the program. It's actually very impressive how highly organized they are. And that chief was like, yeah, I used to, when I got prepped for the program, I would ride my bike or run to the gym, do my workout, and then come back. And the light bulb kind of went off. It's like, you got to do a little more than, you know, just doing a workout. You got to kind of stack it on. And then shortly after that, I met a really big mentor of mine, Matt McGee. He's currently a lieutenant for Orlando, but he was a fireman at the time. And he had gone through Smoke Diver Florida's program three times. So he kind of gave me his whole plan on what he did to prepare. And he also invited me to work out with him one day at his station. And I've told this story a few times, but we did like a coat and pants workout because it was so hot that day. And I remember we did this. It was like a 5-round workout. It had tire hits, tire flips, stuff that you would see in like a normal firefighter type of course. And by round three, I had to like take my stuff off and he wasn't even phased. So it just kind of like, it made me realize I wasn't where I needed to be. And training in gear is completely different than actually just being, having a general physical fitness or physical preparedness, because, and there's studies out there that prove this, you could be a high level CrossFit athlete, but if you put them in gear and have them do any type of, you know, firefighter type movements, it's much different. And they're probably going to even struggle as well. But there's a little curve there that if they, the more they do it, the more acclimated they'll get. And, you know, the more fit you are, the easier it is to acclimate, is what I'm trying to say. But if you don't do it at all and you are a firefighter, you're really doing yourself a disservice, because it's a completely different environment, especially if you are in a state that is hot or hot and humid, because the humidity plays a huge factor as well.
It's fucking brutal here.
Yeah.
There's no question about it.
Yeah. I try to explain it to some people who aren't from here. I just tell them, like, you could walk outside and take your trash out and you're already sweating. And we were even talking about it the other day. I said the summer actually felt better this year. It was hot. Don't get me wrong. It was really hot. But now, like, we've been getting a lot of rain lately. It's not quite as hot. You know, it's in the mid to high 80s, but it feels worse because of how high the humidity is. Like, you look at the weather, the humidity is like 87%. And it's like completely different than if it was just hot in the summer. Don't get me wrong. The heat index in the summer was like probably 102, 105, but it was just, the humidity makes it way worse. It's crazy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I got to experience both because I worked for Anaheim, California for a few years. And every time I did my blooming orientation or academy, it was always the summer.
Right.
And so you're out there and yeah, it's just kind of like, you know, like you're standing in front of an oven, but it is that dry heat, you know, and so you get that evaporation when you sweat. Here, it's like sweating in a swimming pool. You're not actually really cooling. And then obviously you put your gear on, which is designed not to let anything out. I mean, that's the one thing. And I did okay when I was on the job, but I noticed that that was the one of the things that I started losing when I got older as a firefighter, is your ability to acclimatize seemed to diminish. And I would do MRF in gear. And towards the end, and especially when I transitioned out where my Y wasn't strong to be in gear anymore, you know, it felt like my organs were literally cooking. Like, I could do the movements, like all of them, the push-ups. I've always kind of struggled with, you know, multiple push-ups. But the pull-ups and the squats and the runs are always fine. But it was the heat. Same with the stair climbs, you know, trying to get ready. When I was prepping for the smoke diver here before I tore my meniscus, I was doing, you know, all the gear. And we had a 28-story hotel next to my station in my last place. And we were doing the, you know, the 110-story climb on air and everything. And it wasn't the exertion. It was the heat. And that's, like you said, that's a hard thing to control, because you either you can or you can't at the end of the day.
Yeah, and some of it does come down to mental resiliency, because, you know, since I started my page, Rogue Firemanship, I get questions all the time related to smoke diver stuff. And it seems like the number one question I get is, like, what type of workout should I be doing? And it's very hard because everybody's different. Everybody has their own strength and weaknesses. So, you know, you may be an endurance athlete, so you don't necessarily need to do as many endurance workouts. Maybe we just need to focus on some strength and still get you in gear, and, you know, vice versa. But the main thing I tell them is there's really never too much you can do to prepare for a program like that. Everybody's going to get to a point where they hit a wall, and it's going to be up to you to decide whether you want to keep going or not. And it doesn't matter how fit you are. Everybody's going to hit that wall. Now, granted, everybody may hit it at different levels. You don't want to hit that level like I did the first time I went at 30 minutes into the program. But you just have to make the conscious decision that you have to compartmentalize what you're going through and just break it down to one step at a time or a couple feet at a time if you're doing a search evolution, or if you're dragging a dummy out, like, all right, let me just get 10 more feet and then I can stop, or I'm not stopping until I at least get to the door, stuff like that. And you do that through your training. You have to do training that is going to push you. And these 10-minute AMRAPs, 15-minute AMRAPs like CrossFit is designed for, isn't necessarily going to get you there. It's definitely a tool in the toolbox. But I tell people, you have to be able to be in your gear. If you seriously want to go through a program like that, you have to be able to at least be in your gear for an hour somewhat comfortably. Now, I'm not going to lie to you. Once I hit the 40, 50, 60 minute mark, like, I have to dig deep to keep going. But if you just do a 20 minute gear workout and that's all you do for that day or for the week, that's not going to be enough to get you through.
What do you tell people as far as the to be in gear, to not be in gear? I'm literally about to interview Diane Cotter, who she lost her husband to cancer, and she was one of the first people to be talking about PFAS in our gear. And it's a completely legitimate conversation, of course. But at the same time, the other part of it is that we have to be in gear sometimes. And until they figure out getting all that stuff out, there's a kind of happy medium there. So I've talked to John Spearer about this and some other people that are, you know, known to work out in their gear. What is your response about, you know, do, don't, or a middle ground?
So the first thing I'll say is I'm not 100% expert on the PFAS. I've done a little bit of research, and from my perspective, it's very hard to know what to believe, because you have one person saying that it can get absorbed through the skin, and then you have another scientist saying that maybe not necessarily, it may be a molecule too big. So we don't know for sure. And secondly, there are definitely resources out there that if you're not comfortable wearing gear to work out in, that there's one company I've seen recently, they're starting to gain traction. It's called Karna Bunker Gear. And it's a guy who saw that as a problem, and he created PFAS-free training bunker gear. So it's obviously not bunker gear you can go into an IDOH with, but if you want to just train in it and get acclimated to the heat, he actually made it to where it's almost a little hotter than normal bunker gear because it's not letting the heat out. And then the third thing I would say is, for this is me personally, you know, this is not the department I work for speaking. This is me. It's an inherited risk that we may or may not have to accept. And my priority is being able to operate at a high level on the fire ground when I may need to. And to do that, you have to train in your gear. And what I will say, though, is there's no excuse for training in dirty gear. And by dirty, I mean any gear that's been in a structure fire. So make sure if you go into a fire, I'm very lucky, the department I work at, we have two sets of gear minimum. So when we come back from a fire, I throw my dirty set in the extractor. All of our stations have extractors. I wash it immediately. I switch into my second set of gear, and they let us be out of service so we can shower and decon and clean all of our stuff off. I think that's, to me, I think that's more important than necessarily the PFAS conversation. And also from my research, there's PFAS in everything. I'm more worried about what I'm drinking, what I'm eating. I think some of that stuff is probably going to kill us more than the PFAS. But like I said, I'm no expert. It's a risk that I'm willing to take because I don't want to be able to be on a call where I know I could have pushed a little harder if I was acclimated to my gear and more comfortable in it versus not. And now I'm second guessing my performance. Because like I said earlier in this conversation, you can do all the CrossFit and weightlifting workouts you want. It still doesn't necessarily prepare you for the demands of being in your gear.
Yeah, 100%. It was interesting. I had a guy, Rob Bellott, who was the lawyer, the real lawyer from the Dark Waters movie where they exposed, I think it was DuPont, and that's where this all came from. And yeah, apparently pretty much all of us have PFAS in us already, sadly, because of contaminated water and everything else. But when a lot of, you know, that started being a conversation in the fire service, what I saw was a lot of finger pointing, like, oh, this is where cancer's coming from. And my whole thing was, all right, so you're not going to talk about a much more powerful known carcinogen, which is sleep deprivation. Right. So you're going to point your finger over here, but you're not going to look in the mirror and say, we're also probably far more likely causing cancer to our people by, you know, these crazy work weeks and this mandatory overtime. So that's what kind of sickened me. Of course, you want to minimize every element that's going to be detrimental. But if you put on the table, which is more important, the PFAS or the sleep deprivation is the first thing we've got to address. Doesn't mean you can't simultaneously get gear that doesn't have it in. But I mean, your AFFF has it in. I mean, there's a lot of other things that does. But yeah, if you're going to stand on a podium all of a sudden because you get to point to someone else rather than to your own department, that's why I think it took off so much. They got to blame someone else rather than take ownership.
Yeah, that's what I always would scratch my head about too, because even before the talk of changing schedules, you know, I'd say probably like 5 years ago, the last 3 to 5 years, the cancer thing's been a big deal, right? And they've been talking about, you know, how dirty gear was causing cancer, which I don't discredit 100%. But if you look at the statistics, other than, you know, the old firemen and the warriors where they didn't have SCBAs and where they were really burning pretty much every day, multiple fires a day, we fast forward to now, the statistics show that, you know, we are not burning as much, but the cancer rates are still at the same level, maybe a little higher. It's probably not the fires we're going to. And that was the thing I always said. I said, it's the sleep deprivation. It's the shift work, which is known as a, I forgot what class and what type it is, but it's known as a carcinogen, like you said. And, you know, that is something else that we can control. And some departments are at least being proactive and trying to do that. And it was kind of like the whole, you know, I laughed too, because when the clean cab concept came out, it was such a knee-jerk reaction. They were like, let's just move the SCBAs and the gear outside of the cab of the truck. And it's like, if it's all clean, then how is it off-gassing and getting people sick? You know, like people don't understand that the clean cab concept also stated that you need to have extractors at every station, two sets of gear, and you need to decon right after a fire. The stuff outside the cab was just another thing you could do, but it wasn't necessary. It wasn't a thing you had to do. And I think a department down south, I can't remember if it was Miami-Dade, but it was a big department. They actually came out, they went clean cab, and then a short time later, they actually issued a statement and said, we're no longer doing that. That was a bad idea. We're going to do two sets of gear and all that stuff.
See, a lot of I had the guys that were actually the Swedish firefighters that created the clean cab, you know, the Skellefteå model, I think they call it. And it was really interesting to hear. But when you start hearing this again, the pendulum swings and then you get this epic pushback and then you hear clean cabs save grabs, like you're going to just jump heroically off the rig and just fly into a fucking building without taking any time to size it up. And,
right,
you know, I was a tillerman in California. Well, you can't put your pack in the doghouse. It has to be down there. And when you do that, you realize that it takes seconds to sling it over your shoulders and then, you know, throw your mask on and click in. Meanwhile, your LT is telling you what they want to do, or captain in that case, or you're, you know, just simply sizing it up, or, you know, you're, the person who was in the cab is going to obviously be ready a little bit closer than you are, or a little bit sooner. They're grabbing a tool and handing it to you, whatever it is. You've got that moment. So I actually like the idea of the cab being out because I lived it. And also, if you think about it, when you're on the way to a call, when is it that you're not wearing your seatbelt? It's when you're fucking around with your SCBA. Yeah. And if you get into a wreck, what's happening? That thing is slamming into your bag. You know, I mean, you're getting hung up on all the, you know, the headphone cables and all that stuff. So I actually like the packs being on the outside. You know, now that, you know, like you said, if you've got an extracted clean set of gear, of course that could be in the cab if it's clean. If it's supposed to be clean, it's clean. But the pack itself, if you think about it, if you had a normal seat, you stepped off, opened a compartment, slung that thing around while, you know, you're surveying the scene or waiting for instructions, and you're just taking it all in, it's seconds. It's absolutely just seconds. And no one in their right mind is going to leap off a fire engine and go straight into a building. Right. So there's also that fallacy with the pushback on the clean cab, because it doesn't mean it's supposed to be a surgical room, you know.
Right.
It's just removing some of those things that are detrimental. And then the pack is so hard to truly decontaminate. You can't put a pack in an extractor, you know. So
sure,
if you've got the special machines, then yeah, but a lot of times we're still just hosing and scrubbing those. So I'm personally for keeping those outside specifically.
Yeah, and it's no different than, like, you know, we call them rescues, but they're ambulances in my city, and that's where their packs are. They're in a compartment with tools and the tick. And, you know, I'm currently a driver, but lately I've been riding up as officer. And same thing, like you said, it's no different. I don't have tools up in the front seat with me either. So I have to get out, get my tools, and sure, I wouldn't be opposed to having an air pack on the outside, but I want my gear to be able to be in the truck and I can get it on while we're in the bay, while I'm looking at the notes, hop in the truck, put my seatbelt on and go to the call. I don't want to have to get off the truck and put my bunker gear on, then my air pack, as I have to then go and size the building up, do a 360. God forbid there's somebody trapped. You know, it's just one less thing I would like to have to worry about. The air pack, like you said, not a big deal, but the whole clean cab thing, there was everything outside.
Yeah. And I think this is it. You know, what works for one place doesn't mean that you have to do it exactly right. But the principle is get you know, as much of that shit out as you can if it makes sense. You talked about, you know, the humility that you had as far as realizing you had weaknesses with the first attempt for Georgia Smoke Diver. So talk to me about how your training shifted and then the success through the program.
Yeah, so it was a pretty long journey. So in 2017, went through Georgia's program. Obviously didn't make it through. I came back, slowly started changing my training style, started doing more stuff in gear. And, you know, doing more like circuit training, longer circuits as well. Then I met Matt and he kind of showed me what the next level was and he took me under his wing and, you know, I would meet with him some mornings before shift to do either a 9/11 stair climb, which you know how physically demanding those are and, you know, or whatever workout he wanted to do for the day. And I liked really training with him because he would never tell me what the workout was beforehand, like until I got there. And that was nice. And I joke with him sometimes because I would tell him I wouldn't sleep the night before some mornings before the workout because I was like just anxious about what he's going to put me through because they were that bad. And so we fast forward to December of 2018. I didn't get into the Georgia program that time. They run two programs a year. They run it in the spring and the fall typically. As an out-of-state candidate, I applied. I didn't get in for whatever reason. And so he made some phone calls and he got me into the Florida program, which was running that December. And so I go and I wasn't quite training as hard as I needed to, but I didn't know that. I thought I was doing everything I needed to do, but it's one of those things you don't know what you don't know. So I went to Florida and I remember that first day was just like a kick in the teeth. Made it through the first day and so I wasn't really aware of how to properly eat and hydrate for a program like that. And at the time I was kind of, I wouldn't say I was trained this way, but most people, I think when they do a hard workout, they kind of lose their appetite. Right. So I wasn't eating nearly enough cause I wasn't hungry. I didn't bring stuff with me that I could just like chug to get the calories in. And I had no idea about electrolytes. So I'm just, they're telling us, keep drinking water, drink water, drink water. You guys should be pissing every 5 minutes, you know, like, which is true. Like you should be hydrating. So I make it through the first day. I was kind of cramping up that night, was very uncomfortable. Make it to the next day. And that morning during one of the PT sessions, we were doing a bear crawl workout and I just had a full body cramp. And it was one of the worst. I'm already a cramper and a sweater, but this was one of the worst cramps I'd ever had because my whole abdominal and my hip flexors and quads like cramped up at the same time.
That's a shitty position to cramp in. It must have like an angry croissant at that point.
Yeah. So I basically like, I squirmed around and I'm like on my back and laid out. And two of the cadre members, they kind of stood over me and it was Basil and another guy named Russ. And they just stood over me. They didn't yell. They were pretty calm and they just stood over me and they're like, hey man, you can either get up and keep going and win or you could just quit, but you got to decide now. And I'm still locked up. So I roll over, I bear crawl till we finished, till they told us to stop. And to that point, that was at that point in my life and in my physical, physical preparedness and fitness, that was the most I'd ever been pushed. And so that was kind of a little bit of a win for me. Got through that, finished the day out. We did some skills because they, regardless to, contrary to popular belief, like they do teach you stuff in smoke divers. Some people think that you just get your ass beat the whole week. Like it's not like that at all. They teach you a lot of stuff. And that night during the burn, I just didn't have enough in the gas tank. So I failed out on the burn. And then, went home, took a long, hard look in the mirror, asked Matt what I needed to do. And Matt was like, you just need to train harder. And so spent the whole year again training with him, went back to Florida again. Cause after, at that point, because Florida was so close, you know, it's right here in Ocala. I live in Claremont. It's only an hour drive versus the 9 hour drive to Dalton for Georgia's program. At that point, I was like, I just want to be a Florida smoke diver because I'm from Florida and it's not being lazy, but it was just more convenient for me to drive an hour versus 9 to 10 hours. So didn't apply anymore to the Georgia program. My sole focus was on Florida. came back again that next year, took a whole nother year to train, and I made it all the way to the final evolution and came up short. And without giving it away too much, I mean, it's not too much of a secret, but it's essentially a search evolution where you end up finding your poker chip. And but they tell you if you miss searchable space or you miss a victim, you have to repeat wherever you were searching. And it got to a point where I was so gassed that I started making some mental mistakes, kept having to repeat my searches. And before I knew it, I was searching for over 2 hours. And they finally had to tell me to stop and pulled me out, because even the one guy who runs it, he was like, dude, I thought you were just going to, like, you were trying to kill yourself. And, but I did, I had that mindset, and because I knew I was so close that I was just going to keep going because, you know, I was so close. And I, at that point, you know, 2.5, 3 years of training, like, I'm going for it. And they weigh us before and after that evolution. And they had me get assessed by the medic on site there. He had me step on the scale. I think I had lost either like 12 or 14 pounds of water just in that evolution. I remember I was the most thirsty I had ever been. Like, I had the worst cotton mouth, but I kept telling myself, like, dude, you just get through this. They'll give you a bottle of water, then you get to go search for your chip. Like, we're almost there, you know, and they just kept getting further and further away. And dude, I remember I just, like, when they pulled me out, and not a lot of people know this, but I was just bawling my eyes out because, you know, I never pushed myself that far. And then it was kind of like the Rolodex kind of played in my head. I was walking down the stairs of just like all the sacrifices and training sessions and all that. It was just like, it was a weird, eerie moment, you know? And it's kind of funny looking back at this, you know, one of the cadre guys, he came up to me right after, you know, I just pulled my shit off. I'm on the ground in the bay sitting down, you know, still crying. And he's like, hey man, you come back next year? And I just looked at him, you know, and I'm like, no, I'm not fucking coming back next year. I just sacrificed 3 years of my life for this, you know? And in the moment, like, you know, at that time I was like, no, I'm not coming back. But as soon as I drove home and got home and pulled in my driveway, it was like, I'm coming back. You know, it's just funny. I look back now and it was like, you know, it's kind of like the cycles of grief almost, you know, you're so I was kind of like in the angry phase at that point. So same thing, man. I took a whole nother year to train, and I was even training with Matt even more. Like, I was going probably once or twice a week to meet with Matt before shift or on, just depending on our schedule. He always had to work out early in the morning because he's a busy guy, and he's a realtor, and he's, you know, got kids, and he's a very good father and family man, and that's the most important to him. So all his training gets done in the morning, like before the sun's up. So there were some mornings I'd have to wake up at 3:30 a.m. to go drive an hour to meet him where he was at and work out. But I wouldn't trade that for the world. He's one of my best friends and one of my biggest mentors. And you know, when you suffer with other people is when you bond. But went back again, and this was my third attempt at Florida, fourth attempt overall at a smoke diver program. Made it to the night before the final scenario and came up short in that burn. So, you know, it was a hard pill to swallow. But, and even the cadre and Matt were like, dude, that was the strongest you've ever looked, you know? And it got to the point where, you know, obviously I wanted to be successful, but every year I went back, dude, I got better. Like, I became a better fireman. I became a better leader. I was bringing people up around me because whatever crew I was on, I was training, and I would be able to get them to join me by my various methods. I'd either turn it into a competition or, you know, it forced me to get down on somebody's level instead of thinking I was superior to them, of meeting them where they were at and being able to motivate and get them to be better as well. And that was also rewarding because it got to the point where, like, some of my buddies at the department are like, dude, how are you going to these crews and getting people to work out in gear with you? You know, and it's like, well, one, I'm doing it. I'm leading by example. And two, I'm not an asshole about it. Whereas early in my career, before I went to Smoke Diver, I tell people this all the time. I was an arrogant little prick. Like, I was the type of guy that, you know, if you didn't train or you didn't do stuff extra, like, you were a piece of shit. And now that I'm older and wiser, that's, you know, I know that's not the case. People have families, they have other jobs. Like, you know, just because you may think they're a piece of shit at the station, does that mean they're a piece of shit husband? Are they a piece of shit father? Probably not. You know, like, we have to learn to show some empathy and humanity, I think, you know, in it. And people are going through things you don't even know about. But so fast forward to 2 years ago was my last attempt at Florida. Same thing, was the strongest I ever been. And I got sick with the flu the night before. Like, I remember I went to dinner. I had dinner with Tony Gillen.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm really good friends with him. And whenever I'm up here, you know, I try to see him. And so I had dinner with him. And I remember I told him, like, dude, I feel like shit right now. I was congested, had a stuffy nose. I didn't sleep the whole night before the class because I couldn't breathe. And I ended up making it 2 days through the program before I finally failed out on the first burn. And, but I got a lot out of that because with me being dog sick like that, I had never pushed myself that far. And, I was supposed to go last, well, so I was sick, didn't make it. I was a little upset and heartbroken about that. Cause sometimes you get unlucky and, you know, a whole year of training just to get sick. Kind of felt like I was a little robbed. And, you know, I remember, earlier that year, me and my wife had a miscarriage. And the baby that we would have had was supposed to be born the week of Smoke Diver. And so I kind of, my way of dealing with some of the grief was I just kept training even harder. And, I'm a big believer in, like, you know, things are meant to be. And the fact that the baby wasn't going to be born that week, I thought, well, maybe it's God saying, like, hey, this is your time to be a smoke diver. You know, you've been putting in a lot of time. You know, sadly, you know, we still grieve that we lost the baby. It was a very hard time. My wife took it very hard. But me personally, that the way I dealt with the grief is I just focused more into my training, and that's what helped me. So that was kind of hard. And I kind of got home and told my wife, Lindsay, like, you know, I think I'm just done with this smoke diver thing. Like, it's not meant to be. I've been training at it for, you know, that was my fifth attempt overall, you know, almost 5 years of hard training. Like, you know, it is what it is. And then I kind of forgot that I was on an alternate list for Georgia. And like a week or two later, they emailed saying there was a spot open. So I put my name in, like, hey, I'm interested. And they're like, oh, you were one of the first ones to reply. So you're in. So less than 4 weeks later after that Florida program, I went to Georgia and was ultimately successful. And my wife, it was funny, I FaceTimed her the night before the final, and the final day. I was like, hey, you know, I made it to the final day, feeling pretty good. And she's in our kitchen, like, oh man, that's great. And I go through the final day, go through the final scenario. I'm in there with the current smoke daddy, Casto, and then Chief Rhodes is also there. Chief Rhodes shakes my hand, gives me a challenge coin, and he says, you know, before you walk through that door and become a smoke diver, you have to do one final search of this room, because prior to that I was searching for my nuts and bolts. And my wife is pretty small in stature, you know, she's like 4'10 4'11 and he steps to the side and she's standing right behind him, and I remember just like immediately breaking down, and I hugged her. And luckily I have some pictures of it and video. And I just remember telling her, like, thank you for putting up with all my training for all these years. And it was pretty nice to, you know, have all that training finally have a little bit of a, you know, an exclamation point at the end of it. You know, I hate to say that, you know, getting a patch or a coin, it doesn't matter in the grand scheme of things, but it is nice when you are successful and finally see things through.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah, I had Chief Rhodes on the show, Todd Edwards, some of the Georgia guys, and then I had obviously multiple people from Florida as well. And they do sound like two slightly different programs. So with all that preparation chasing the Florida one, how prepared did you feel for the Georgia one in the end?
So I felt very prepared, at least physically and a little bit mentally, because, you know, I had been pushed pretty hard before. So when it started to get hard in the Georgia program, it wasn't an unfamiliar feeling. Cause I get the question all the time. Like, people ask me, oh, which one is easier? And I don't really feel comfortable saying one is easier than the other because they're just different. The one thing I will say though, is that Georgia you have more opportunities if you mess something up to redeem yourself versus the way that the Florida program is laid out, because you're basically burning every single day and you have a high chance of, if you're not going to make the objective, it's going to be probably during a burn, that you're not going back in to redeem yourself because you're getting pulled out and it's bad. You know what I mean? Or you're already so smoked. They're not putting you back in another burn. Like, there's no way because of how hot it is. So that's the only difference. But I would say both programs more or less teach the same things. It's just a different, different like structure, and it's organized a little differently. But I tell people all the time, it's, if you're interested or thinking about going, you should, because they do teach you things. And you're not the problem. I shouldn't say the problem, but when you go to conferences or you go to a class and you're learning a skill, and then you do a scenario later that day to practice that skill, it's still valuable and it's still good, but it's not the same as when you're super smoked and super tired. And Chief Rhodes has even said this multiple times for the Georgia program. It's about day three is where people are getting what they came for. You know, all the evolutions and the scenarios you do in a smoke diver program are extremely basic, but they're trying to get you to the point where you're extremely exhausted and fatigued, to where now you're having to make multiple decisions under stress and then still be successful, is where you're getting what you came for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like that one phrase, I think it was Customato, wasn't it? Tyson's trainer that originally said it. You know, everyone has a plan until they get hit in the face.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. What about then mentally? You finally, I mean, that's such a crucible. I've had people on here, Julian Serrano, some other ones that obviously didn't make it the first time, but no one has had that 5-year, you know, 6-try journey that you've had. You finally get there. What are those weeks and months like for you later when that thing that you've been chasing for so long has finally been achieved?
Yes, I would say mentally, I was on a high for probably like, you know, I'd say a month. Like, I was pretty stoked. I was still training though. Like, as soon as I got back, I was still in gear and training. And then once that high kind of wore off, I was looking at Florida again. And it's kind of just, I think a lot of people don't understand it. Even some people in my family, they had made the comment like, well, you're already a smoke diver. Like, why do you need to go to Florida? And for me, it's just unfinished business. I was always raised by my hardworking parents. Like, you don't quit anything and you see it through till it's done. And also another part of it is, I've gained a lot of friends and relationships from going to Florida so many times, and those guys making it through, that I just want to be part of the club, man. Like, not that they don't accept me now that I'm not a Florida smoke diver, but it is different when you get to be on the other side.
Especially when you got so close so many times.
Yeah, exactly. And I've talked to Basil about this before too, and he even agrees. It luck does play a little bit into it, and it does suck when you're a little unlucky. But that's the other thing. I know I'm capable of doing it. And honestly, I just enjoy the training leading up to it. And I enjoy the program because you're not getting that type of training anywhere else. When I do training at the department, like I said, you're always fresh, or it's the same training that you've been doing the last 3 years in the same burn building, that, you know, you're not getting stimulus out of that. So, I was supposed to go last January, but I had a pretty significant back injury, which that was a whole nother round of adversity that I had to get through.
How did you get through that? Did you have to have surgery, or did you manage to PT?
So luckily I didn't need surgery. I don't know exactly what did it, but I started having some pain in my back, and it started kind of like in the lower right side where your glute kind of meets the lower back. And I was not really paying too much attention to it because I'd strained my back before and it kind of felt similar to that. But then as time went on, and I kept training, the pain kept traveling down lower and lower. And then finally, I just woke up one morning after doing a pretty hard workout the day before. And I woke up, I felt a little bit of pain. I took a hot shower. That didn't really help. So I took my massage gun and I massaged the back of my, where the pain was. And when I did that, it like was like an explosion went off in my back. And it was 10 out of 10 pain. I was on the floor. And it was the worst pain I'd ever felt in my life. And I crawled to the bed, tried to get in the bed to get comfortable, and nothing was working to alleviate the pain. And luckily I had some leftover painkillers from my nasal surgery that I had a few months prior. I took one of those, and about 30 minutes in, it barely masked the pain. Like, it just made it somewhat more to where I wasn't squirming around in the bed. And what ended up happening is I had an L5 S1 disc herniation that was impinging the sciatic nerve. And so sitting was like the worst. And then driving to work was even more painful just because of that like nerve floss where my foot was on the gas. It was my right side. So my foot was on the gas pedal. And so I had to call out of, I called out of work for like two shifts, and I finally got the pain to where it was tolerable, but I could barely bend down and touch my knee. And I was pretty much just like limping into work, told my Lou like, hey, look, if we have to pick somebody up off the ground, there's not much I can do. I said, I could throw a ladder. I was driving at the time. So I was like, I'll hump some hose and throw a ladder. But, you know, and eventually it started feeling a little better, but not to the point where I could work out. So I went and saw a spine surgeon. And so he sent me to get an MRI, came back, and he said, you don't need surgery, luckily. But he said he recommended steroid injections. And so I did my research on the, I think it's like a corticosteroid. Mm-hmm. And I really did not like the results I was seeing on that. I was seeing a lot of people would have to go back for multiple injections. And that I was reading online, the multiple injections can actually lead to degeneration. So I didn't like that at all. I kind of Googled like, you know, what else can you do for a back injury? And a clinic over in Winter Park called Regenix popped up. And they offered PRP injections. So I went there, and I really liked the doctor there. His name was Dr. Torrance. He actually bounces between the Tampa, St. Pete, and Winter Park area because he's a specialist for the spine. But what I really liked about him is he was very fit, and he was like a CrossFitter. So he knew exactly kind of what I was going through. You know, I don't want to say I was depressed, but I was slightly depressed because I couldn't work out anymore. You know, gained some weight, was pretty much stuck on the couch on my days off. And so he recommended the injections. I got those the first week of January. And he pretty much said, like, hey, it'll take about 16 weeks before you're, like, back to 100%. And within, like, 2 to 3 weeks, I started noticing results. I went to physical therapy, which I was a little disappointed in the physical therapy. It was kind of a joke. I hate to say it. But once I went there a few times, I told him, like, just give me the plan and give me the exercises. I'll just do this at home because I have a full garage gym at home. And so I did that. It helped a little bit, but not as much as I wanted. And it was really just the time is what I needed to heal. And no shit. Like he said, around the 16-week mark, I finally woke up in the morning with no pain. Because as the time went on, I was getting less pain. Like the more I moved around, it wouldn't feel bad during the day, but the morning would be bad. So I was pretty much taking Tylenol like every day. I mean, I was taking Tylenol around the clock, like 1,000 milligrams at a time, to the point where I finally got to that 16-week mark. Didn't have any more pain at all. And now I'm like, you know, I'm almost 10 months post that injection and I'm pretty much back to 100%. I mean, I think you saw me competing mm-hmm. at the 343 and gave me no issues other than just being a little sore the next, you know, that night and the next.
Brilliant. I know. Talk to me about foundation training too, because I did that when I hurt my back. It was, God, well, we must be at least, I think, 10 years ago. And that was incredible for healing. So did you incorporate that during that time?
Yeah, I was doing that like once a week because Sparrow had sent me a video that he shares with his Patreon community like once a week. They have a free YouTube. I think it's like a 10-minute.
Yeah, 12-minute foundation training.
Yeah, like a weekly thing. And that helped a lot too. And just, you know, as I get older now, I realize I have to actually warm up before workout and stretch and not be as hard-headed and listen to my body more, because before it was like, I just, you know, I got to stack it on. I got to just keep pushing through. And now I'm a little more intentional with my training and I pay a lot more attention to my body. Because if I realized, you know, I pushed myself that one day and maybe if I would have just backed off for a few weeks, I would have probably been fine to go to Florida and not, I mean, I couldn't work out for almost 2 months. So, you know, it's kind of like in hindsight, it's always 20/20. But it's like, okay, I could have just maybe backed off a little bit and still kept my physical fitness to where it was and continue to gradually get better versus I took off almost 2 months, which I got it back pretty a lot quicker than I thought. But I mean, the first few weeks of getting back into it, it kind of sucked, especially like the first few runs I did. It was like my calves had never known what running was ever.
Well, I think as I've got older, I've realized that whole less is more is really a real thing, especially as you are aging as well. You can, you know, destroy yourself when you're young and get away with it. But if you look at the martial arts community, they're doing a lot less full contact sparring now. If you look at strength and conditioning, you don't need to drive yourself into the ground. And when we did the 3-4-3 this year, I've just been doing Wolf Brigade programming. So it's not CrossFit style stuff anymore. I haven't done that for at least a year, but it's a lot of maces and kettlebells. And there is, you know, a Metcon element to it, but it's very strict strength movement. And, you know, it served me very well. 50 years old, I'm still competing with the young lads. And, you know, we didn't obviously podium, but we ended up in the middle of the pack in the end. And it's just kind of cool to see that. Okay, well, you know, you don't have to murder yourself with Murph every day to still be, you know, functional and you know, pain-free at 50 years old and still be able to do the job.
Yeah, like I said, there's a time and a place. You just have to be intentional with what your training is and your goals. And, you know, I'm big on like active recovery days now. And so for that, I'll do either rucking or a walk, or I'll get on my exercise bike and just ride that. And I've been doing a lot of zone 2 running too, because before I would just run all out, and it's like, that's not always the best either. You know, there's a lot of benefit in the zone 2 running and slowing down a little bit, but you're still moving. And then same thing now, you know, almost every shift I get in gear and do a gear workout. And, but, yeah, just, it's been a humbling experience. And that was the other thing I tell people too, is like, before I had my back injury, I don't want to say I was taking training for granted, but it was starting to feel kind of like a chore. I was kind of getting a little burnt out with it. And then when it got completely taken away, now my mindset is whenever I do a workout or whenever it's like getting hard, I'm just grateful. Like, I'm just grateful that I'm able to, you know, sign up for a CrossFit competition and compete and not get hurt and be able to enjoy it and have fun.
Absolutely. Well, I want to get to the firemanship, but just before we do, you touched on again about, you know, the guy, for example, doesn't seem to want to work out. He's a piece of shit. You know, there is that element, especially when you have owned your strength and conditioning despite the environment that you're in. So you have, you know, these deconditioned guys that sit in the lazy boy and say it's always the fit guys that get hurt. I mean, I've heard it my whole career. But there's obviously, you know, a two-part element of this conversation. Ownership is part of it, but also the environment. And I teach a free class in Iron Legion here. And it's really hard to get people to come, and it's free for fire, police, military, corrections, dispatchers. But up here, they're 56 hours a week, constant mandatories. So the other side of it is that, well, when they get to go home, they just want to, you know, go home, be with their kids. They don't want to be, you know, working out in a CrossFit gym. So I think this is the other part of that 24/72 conversation, is when you give them more rest and recovery, then you can put that bar back. So with that being said, you know, let's say, for example, your department shifts to that. What are your thoughts on fitness standards in the fire service? Because to me, you know, I have special forces soldiers, I have ocean lifeguards. I was a lifeguard myself for quite a while too. If you don't hit that bar every year, you're not a lifeguard anymore. It's just that simple. But police and fire, you know, where lives are at stake, admin, unions, there's so much resistance to a simple fitness standard, and one that, you know, you don't have to reinvent the wheel. A CPAT, a fire sled version of it, something that's functional with tools that we have to use, is fair for men, women, you know, 18, 50, whatever it is. So what is your kind of overall philosophy on a fitness standard in our profession?
Yeah, I think there should definitely be some sort of fitness, either agility test or assessment every year that you have to complete. So we just implemented one, like a year or two ago in our department. And like you would expect, we had a lot of pushback from, you know, the union, and it is what it is. But I think, there should be some sort of assessment. And before that, I would have family members or friends who were not in the fire service. They would ask me like, oh, you have to be fit to do the job. Like, don't you have to do an annual assessment every year? And I'd say, no, we currently at my department, you just have a pre-hire physical agility, and that's it. And that's the case in a lot of departments. And the look of shock on their face always just made me laugh. And it was always frustrating to me. But, you know, at the end of the day, and I tell the new guys this too, is you can only control what you can control. And the greatest way to create change or change the culture in your department is by doing it yourself and then with your crew. and eventually you will change the department. Because what ends up happening is if you have a crew culture where everybody knows on the crew that when you guys show up, you know, you're going to eat together, you're going to do all the chores together, you're going to hang around the kitchen table or on the front bumper, and, you know, you're going to work out or do some sort of training together that day, then whenever things happen, such as promotions or, you know, shift changes, or maybe some people leave and they have to go fill a spot somewhere else, whoever gets moved, they're going to go to that new crew, and then they're kind of like your ambassador. And hopefully they continue doing what you guys were doing on this crew. They create some buy-in over there, and then they're able to change that crew. And then over time, it's like a domino effect. And I get that question all the time too, because people have asked me, how have you been able to do it? And it's kind of simple, not easy. You know, you just have to start with yourself. And then when people see you doing stuff in the Bay, be welcoming, say, hey, come join me. I just don't want to be alone. Like, you know, I'm doing this workout. One of my favorite workouts to get people involved is I'll set up an O-course type workout. You know, there'll be four or five different like skill stations, if that's what you want to call it, or workout stations. And I'll just put a clock on for a minute or two for each station. And it'll be, you know, a 15 to 30 minute workout. And that way, if you're doing tire hits, if somebody who's very fit wants to do 1,000 tire hits in that 2 minutes, it doesn't matter, because there's only one person at that station. You don't have to worry about overlap. Everybody's kind of focused on doing their own thing. They're not watching what the other person's doing. And it's to their fitness level. You know, I tell people too, like, you don't have to be in your gear. How about you just put your air pack on, you know, and start there, or just put your coat on. And, you know, it's kind of a, I don't know where I heard this quote, but I've heard it a lot of times. And they say, you know, to have a high standard for yourself, but be tolerant of others, and then, you know, get them elevated to that standard. So, but going back to your original question on yearly, you know, physical assessments, I mean, I'm sure you know my take on it, but it's not as easy as somebody wanting that. There's a lot of implications. You know, the union doesn't want people to lose their jobs. Admin doesn't want people getting hurt. And so there's a lot of red tape involved with that type of stuff.
It's interesting, because I've seen the pushback on the shift change, you know, the shift schedule change. And it's the same with this. If you take a step back and think that you're opposing the things that allow you to perform as a firefighter and also contribute to you having a healthy retirement, and you're opposing that, it's such a backward way of thinking. And this knee jerk about, oh, they're trying to take our jobs. Of course, if when you finally get to implement an actual, you know, punitive fitness standard, there needs to be an on-ramp session of, you know, a year, 2 years, whatever it is, to allow these people that have been deconditioned to get back to where they need to be. And like I said, coupled with a work week that encourages them to be fit, again, gives them the energy, stops destroying their hormones, you know, all these things. But after, you know, once you've got to that point, you know, you've got to understand that there is no downside to a fitness standard, especially if it's a fair one. Like I said, you use, you know, ladders and hose and dummies and all the things that you would have to do in an actual fire. That is what makes it fair. You don't have to do max jump tests and deadlifts and things that, you know, don't really carry over, you know. So, but I think that's what's going to be nice to see, hopefully go hand in hand with this improved work week, is putting the standard back up. Because when you're talking about the recruitment side, young, driven firefighter recruits want to go to somewhere that they're held to a high standard, somewhere that's a challenge, you know. And if you're already fit when you walk through the door as a young recruit, and you then see, okay, every year I'm going to be held to the standard, then 20 years later, 25 years later, hopefully healthy 55, you know, whatever year old firefighters are then going to have an amazing retirement, versus, oh, the fittest I ever was in the academy, which is a really piss poor thing to do, to hear from someone who's been on 15, 20 years, and now they're on statins and a CPAP and all this thing because no one ever held them to a standard.
Yeah, and like you said, you know, changing the work schedule, I think that's the other thing, is right now the biggest issue, at least in the, you know, Central Florida area, is recruitment and retaining firefighters. So if you go to a more desirable schedule, you're going to have a line of recruits lined up at the door to get in. And, you know, like right now, a lot of departments are having issues just putting asses in the seats. So they definitely don't want to get rid of anybody, because then it just exacerbates the problem. So changing the work schedule, you're going to have a higher quality candidate. More candidates going to be wanting to work there, be held to a higher standard. And then if the person who is on the department doesn't want to, you know, fix the issues that they have,
That's what fire prevention's for.
Yeah. So, like I said, it's such a deep-rooted issue that has so many, you know, red tape, government type stuff that blocks it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm excited because once you've created an environment that allows people to thrive, then you can start addressing these. And like I said, to be fair, now these people are rested enough where they start feeling better and start actually wanting to get back to where they were. So I think it's a very positive, you know, potential movement there. So let's talk about rogue firemanship then. You've gone, you know, through this incredible journey, and I'm so glad that we kind of traversed this smoke diver path that you took, because it kind of illustrates the, you know, the depth of your training and, you know, the do's and the don'ts, all those kind of things. So what made you create your own company? And let's talk about what you offer.
Yeah, so it kind of just started because a couple of my buddies are like, you know, you're always posting on your personal social media, you know, about stuff fire related. They're like, you know, you should make a fire page. And I'd been kind of kicking the idea around for a few years, but just never really knew what I wanted to do. So then last December, I finally just pulled the trigger before my daughter was born. I came up with the company name, Rogue Firemanship. And the reason I chose Rogue is because I feel like I've kind of always had a rogue mentality. I've never always gone with or conformed to like the norm or what, you know, the status quo is. That's never been enough for me. Even growing up, you know, I skateboarded as a kid. So kind of that type of, I don't want to say rebellious, but you know, like skateboarders, BMXers, motocross guys, they're not, their way of thinking and what they stand for is not quite normal to what, how normal society operates or normal like sports teams operate. And then, you know, wrestling, it wasn't very popular when I went through school. You know, it was either football or baseball. And then, you know, coming up through the fire service, I was going to conferences, taking classes, going above the minimum standard. And that was kind of always considered like rogue, right? Like you're not doing what is normal, I guess, in your own four walls of the department. And as far as firemanship, I just always loved how firefighting is, I think it should be like it is an apprenticeship. It's a craft. And it's no different than if you want to be a journeyman, you know, plumber or electrician or journeyman iron worker, right? There's levels to it and it's a craft. You know, if you don't know the basic fundamentals, it's going to make it very hard for you to rise up through the ranks and be a effective leader, because you can, sadly, in the fire service, not necessarily be a great fireman, and you can end up in a company officer role just because you happen to test well that day and you just, you know, learn how to do, say, some checkbox tactics on a piece of paper, and you know, you get the job, and now you have a probie under you that you have to now teach to be a good fireman, which you never took the time to do that. And it's a problem I've seen in every department, you know, not necessarily just mine. So I created the page, and just kind of as an outlet for me to, you know, express my experiences and my opinions on things in the fire service, some things I've encountered. And I also wanted to do like fitness programming for firefighters, because I noticed even when I was coming up, not a lot of firefighter fitness programs, I say that like in quotations, actually had anything in gear. It was a lot of like CrossFit style workouts, lifting, sled pushes and sled drags, which like I said before, those are all great and will help get you prepared for the job, but not quite like working out in gear. And before that, I was always on my personal page, was always posting whatever workouts I was doing just to share with people. And I was always getting people, you know, that would message me and like, say, hey, I just did that workout. Thank you for sharing that. And, you know, they would say them and their crew got it done, which was always so rewarding to me. So I just created the page to just kind of separate my personal social media from that. And it's really taken off. I've had a lot of help. John Sparrow from Fit to Fight Fire and Marcos Orozco from Hard Knock Sunday, they have been with me since its inception and really helped me, you know, get it off the ground. We pretty much text every week and kind of share ideas. And my favorite thing about that is we're all, I guess you could say, like in the firefighter fitness space, but it's not really a competition. Like we just care about people getting more fit. Like I have a couple buddies down in the Southwest Florida area, the Naples area, Mason and Remy, They're both Florida smoke divers. They created a page called Firefighter Endurance. And same thing, they post firefighter workouts every single day. And I, you know, I've helped them, you know, I share their stuff every day and they've asked me stuff and I just give them my opinion. And it's not a competition to me. I just want the fire service as a whole to get more fit. And whether they like John Sparrow's style, Marcos's style, the Firefighter Endurance style, or my style, I don't care. I just, you know, I'm making a little bit of money, but it's not about the money for me. It's just, I want people to get better. And like I said, it's been very rewarding. I started it last December and the page has really taken off. And I get messages all the time of guys, you know, they'll take a picture with their crew and they did one of the workouts and they're like, yeah, before the crew never wanted to work out and now they're working out with me and kind of going through the same things I had gone through. And it's just rewarding to see that they're also having an impact on their crews through the page.
Beautiful. And you offer an actual workout program too?
Yeah, so I offer three different ones. I have a 12-week program that is, it's called the Rogue Operator. And it's very similar to how I train. It was just kind of my style of training that I put together in a 12-week program that somebody can follow from start to finish. And I also offer a monthly training program that is kind of the same style as the Rogue Operator, but it just continues on a subscription basis. It's 4 to 5 workouts a week, mixed in strength and conditioning and gear workouts. That's $20 a month. And then for people who are wanting more than just like the preset workouts, I do one-on-one coaching as well. So I have a couple guys that they're going through smoke diver programs in different states as well as Florida. So I'm writing workouts for them. And I've even had some people that they just wanted to pass their firefighter new hire physical or CPAT. And I've helped some people do that as well. So it's kind of crazy. I was looking at the analytics the other day and between those three programs, I've helped so far over 200 firefighters.
Oh, brilliant.
And it's been over only coming up on 10 months now. So that's been super rewarding and awesome. And it's crazy. You know, people are tagging me and stuff that they're doing, or, you know, they'll buy a hat or a shirt. And it was funny. I was packaging some stuff to send and my wife was looking at the labels and she's like, you're sending this to Canada. And it's just, like I said, dude, I'm nobody from nowhere, man. It's just humbling that somebody all the way from Canada saw the page and wanted to buy a shirt or a hat. Or, you know, it's some people, you know, they give social media a bad name, but I think it can be used for a lot of good as well.
100%. Couldn't agree more. So for people listening, where can they find the site and the page?
So the Instagram page is Rogue Firemanship Training. And then it's also a Facebook page is Rogue Firemanship. And then I have a website as well, roguefiremanship.com.
One more question before we close out. When will your next attempt at the Florida smoke diver be?
So I'm actually going in February of 25. I just did the tryout in September and I got in. I competed with over 100 candidates and was lucky enough to get in. So feeling good, feel stoked to give it one more shot, and I'll be back in February.
Amazing. Well, I want to thank you so much, firstly, from driving all the way up to Ocala, but secondly, for sharing your story. Obviously, we focused a little bit more on the fitness stuff today, but I think it's really important that we kind of put that front and center, because this goes hand in hand with the cancer, the mental health, all the other things. You know, we know that exercise is not only important for our performance, but our longevity as well. And this unique path you've been on, you know, and the humility to talk about, you know, the failures, and I don't perceive them as failures. The journey you've been on is really the success. But, you know, this dogmatic chasing of the Florida smoke divers is a powerful part too. So I want to thank you so much for being so generous with your time and coming on Behind the Shield podcast today.
No problem. Thanks for having me. It's been an honor.